Good evening, everybody. My name's Chris Hughes. I'm with the International Relations Department, and I'd like to welcome you all to this event, which is being organised by the Centre for International Studies at the LSE and the International Relations Department. We're very lucky indeed to have one of China's leading academic experts, but also a well-known diplomat who's had a dual academic diplomatic career, including a posting in the Chinese Embassy in London in the 1990s. We were just discussing how when Professor Ran was here in the 1990s, you couldn't fly to Beijing direct from London. You know, and that's how much things have changed in the intervening years. So he's in the UK for a few days, and we're very happy that he agreed to come in to talk to us about this increasingly difficult issue of responsibility to protect, a principle that's difficult enough for the UK and the US and the Western countries, but poses special problems for a country like China, coming from a very different perspective on the international system. Professor Ran Yongzhe is Deputy Director of the Centre for International Studies in Beijing. He's published widely on various aspects of international relations, and also has done a lot of media work, frequently on Chinese TV, Western TV, US TV, talking about some of the most sensitive issues. So he's someone who very much shapes public opinion as well, both in China and outside China. So I don't think we could have a more distinguished visitor with such a deep expertise, both academic and practitioner, diplomatic. So Professor Ran Yongzhe, please hand over to you, and I think you're going to talk for half an hour or 40 minutes, and then we'll have question and answer.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Professor Hughes. Thank you for your kind introduction. Well, actually, it's my great pleasure to be here, and it's great to be back, actually. 22 years ago, when I was a visiting fellow at the SOAS, School of Oriental and Africa Studies, I very often came here to access the library, also to attend some of the very brilliant public lectures. So I benefit a lot, actually, from LSE. So this is a lot of strange place for me. You know, I understand this is Friday evening, and I very much appreciate your coming and your interest. When I first came to Britain, that was 1992. That also was my first overseas trip. I didn't know much about the outside world, got no clue. And before that, I just had a very brief trip to Hong Kong, at that time before handover to mainland China. So my stay here in the Russell Square, basically I spent most of my time. So it was really amazing and wonderful. Particularly, I find the libraries is a very good place. Usually at that time in China, we just opened up a little in 1992, but we don't do much research and work in the library, because library for me at that time is just somewhere you can borrow books. But here, when I came here, I saw, oh, library has a lot of function. I was it's a studying room. It's really what a very interesting change. But of course now today, back in China and other places, the library, well, every library is the same. Not only you can borrow a book, but also it's a good place to spend your time and to study out there. Just now, Professor Hughes mentioned about this is a pretty sensitive topic, R2P, responsibility to protect. As a matter of fact, my institute, China Institute of International Studies, we organize international seminar. We invite participants from BRICS countries, China, Brazil, India, Russia, and also plus quite a few from Australia and from other Western countries. So we had a two-day good discussion on this. The reason China Institutes of International Studies hosted that seminar because I myself did a piece of writing. I propose RP, Responsible Protection, and people find it interesting. So we think, why not we come up together to have a talk? As you may be aware of that, excuse me, this concept, responsibility to protect, was born from a Canadian-sponsored International Commission on Intervention and the State Sovereignty, and also PLOS, other two reports supported by the United Nations. And one of them even Secretary General Kofi Annan. And it was endorsed, the idea, the concept, basically endorsed in 2005 in the World Summit. So after that, people, some of them are getting very excited. Now they've got a tool to make intervention more a little easier. I think there are some positive sides on this concept. For example, this concept is useful to underscore that the responsibility of all states to act to protect their own and other peoples from mass atrocity crime. However, the story of R2P is quite mixed. It's quite mixed. So tonight, I'd like to share some of my thoughts and some of my observations about this concept. Particularly, I'll focus on one or two of the most controversial part of this concept. I will try to discuss, for example, what is the purpose of intervention. We have to, after all, answer this very basic question. Is there any other way to protect or to do a better job? Or is it just to protect human rights or just stage a regime change? And then how to make sure this responsibility to protect will not be distorted or be abused? Of course, if finally I'll lay out what road or what kind of ideas, what China can really do to shoulder a greater responsibility as a growing power, because everybody now is urging China to do more. So what is China's response? What is the mindset? Let me go to the first one. The key question actually is to protect the human rights or a regime change? That is always the question. Bother me, bother many of my friends, not only in China, but also other BRICS countries, developing countries. One might have thought that the Libya war in 2011, very recently, as an example of how this responsibility to protect might exactly work, because it happened right after the 2005 World Summit. So people say, well, this might be the opportunity to do it. By the way, China abstained in the voting of this 1973 draft resolution, along with other countries like Russia, like India, like Germany, like Brazil. So we abstained, because no veto, particularly from China and Russia, So this draft resolution has been passed. Then in this resolution, it permits the international community to establish the no-fly zone. However, the no-fly zone become a kind of a green light for military action. So we have seen the NATO and American troops stage an airstrike. Then, of course, to remove the Gaddafi government. So what has happened in Libya is quite... I think people have different view on that. On one occasion, of course, you remove the regime. But on the other, till today, what is happening? The continued fighting between different fractions and groups, armed groups. According to United Nations data, there are thousands of different faction and armed groups that keep fighting all the time, day and night, and killing with each other. And this kind of fighting brought this country into a chaotic and a mess situation. The economy is in bad shape, and after all, the human rights are abused. So the ultimate, the starting point actually is this kind of military action is to protect, but now the people on the ground are suffering. But there is one difference, actually, because the CNN and the BBC cameras are out of the ground, so people don't have much ideas of what is going on out there. That's a problem. And after that, there is a lot of crisis, Syria crisis, pumped out. And it turns out thousands of people died, and many more were displaced within and beyond Syria's borders. So to protect or not, that is a question. The Libya and the Syria cases trigger an international debate on the question of what is the ultimate purpose of the protection? To protect the human rights or just stage a regime change? There is a concern, to be very honest, about this R2P, responsibility to protect, that it might legitimize the concept of the right to intervene militarily against the will of the government of the country in question. It can easily be abused to use it as an instrumental to remove the government in any other country, just like the Libya case. In addition, there is another concern that it may create an even bigger human rights problem. At the very beginning, you intend to protect, but after the regime change, you left. So there is a kind of another human rights disaster because of the infighting, because of the atrocities made by both sides. So simply because there is no exit strategy. Intervention is just to try to enter into the kind of intervention, but there's no exit strategy to look after the post-intervention period. No mechanism, no institutions to take care of the post-intervention. Now, this brings me to the second point. Humanitarian intervention or humanitarian diplomacy. I try to argue that frequent use of military force in the name of protection is bound to encourage bellicosity in international relations and likely to open a Pandora's box. Humanitarian intervention is indeed an unacceptable assault on state sovereignty. Whereas the intervention focused one-dimensionally on military reaction, it is viewed as the right, quote-unquote, of big powers, big states, to throw their weight around militarily. So they can be easily abused by big power. But non-intervention is an important part of the UN Charter. However, in reality, there were cases that actions eventually taken by a coalition of the winner, but without or bypass the authority of the Security Council. Thus, it poses a challenge to the integrity of the whole international security system. Gary Evans noted how the developing nations, they have their view on the sovereignty. He said, many new states born out of decolonialization are very proud of their new owned sovereignty, very conscious of their own fragility, and all too conscious of the way in which they had been on the receiving end in the past of not very benign intervention from the imperial and the colonial powers. So they are not very keen to acknowledge their right to do so again under whatever circumstances. So against this backdrop, Brazil presented a concept of responsibility while protecting. So a little difference from R2P in 2011. Basically, it seeks to reflect the serious defect regarding the implementation of military measures in the responsibility to protect framework. The question here is there any alternative way to execute protection? Indeed, there are many other ways to save lives rather than just rely on the humanitarian intervention through military means. It is better, for example, to strengthen the humanitarian diplomacy, such as providing funding to improve public health services, resettling refugees, aiding victims of natural disasters, also as a means to fulfill the responsibility to protect through non-violent means, which will have a far more positive and enduring impact. As a member of UNDP Human Development Report Advisory Panel, I myself believe that the international community should do more to build the resilience of human security. Of course, the challenge now is how to rebuild a new international consensus by pursuing all those ideas further. Then it brings me to the last part of my presentation. What is the alternative? What's your thought? So what is the responsible protection? And for years, people urged China to speak out, to act, and to shoulder greater responsibility. Let's say you are already number two, and you should do more, right? It is a legitimate call. I think China should do more. However, be careful what you're wishing for. It might become true. That is to say, when China speaks out, it may not necessarily what you like. It may not necessarily every time you have the agreement. And as a matter of fact, currently, Chinese foreign policy, we have a kind of nuanced narrative on the Chinese great power for diplomacy with Chinese characteristics. It sounds quite familiar, right? Deng Xiaoping said we are pursuing the socialism with Chinese characteristics. What does really mean here, the Chinese great power diplomacy with Chinese characteristics? That actually means in this, while China attach great importance of its relations with great power to dealing with great powers, however, equally important, China now, you have to act, behave as a great power. As we all understand, power and the responsibilities are two sides of one coin. So, here, let me take Syria crisis as an example. Many people, particularly from West, they're very much disappointed about China's veto, the draft resolution concerning the Syria crisis. Not just once, not just twice, not just a third, but fourth time, but four. So it has been unprecedented. If you look at China's vote record in the United Nations Security Council. However, I should say China is no friend of Bashar Assad. And even I ask some of my Chinese friends, they fail to locate, they fail to locate where Syria is on the world map. And China doesn't have any significant economic and trade ties with Syria, by the way. Unlike Russia. Russia does has a significant strategic interest in Syria. China does. But what's the driving force for China to make this decision? As a matter of fact, China veto because China believes it is defending the UN Charter. We should not allow the Libya case be repeated again. A couple of questions here needs to be answered. For example, do we have an exit strategy? Then what is the follow-up efforts to protect the people and human rights other than just focus on regime change? Apparently, it is easier to top down a government than bring enduring peace and stability to the country. It is easier to hit and run than rebuild a nation. So, to build upon all those responsibility to protect and also responsibility while protecting presented by Brazil, I try to articulate a concept as responsible protection, RP. It is a kind of a regarded as an effort, as a complementary set of principles and procedures. This concept attempts to argue first, any intervention should protect innocent civilians in the countries concerned as well as the regional peace and stability rather than specific political factions or armed forces. Second, the United Nations Security Council is the only body with the legitimacy to implement humanitarian intervention no other body or individual state should claim this right. When military intervention is involved with the mandate of the United Nations Security Council, it must take considerable account of the seriousness of harm involved, right intention, last result, proportionality, and the balance of consequences. Third, the necessary precondition for the implementation of force must be that all diplomatic and the political means of settlement have been exhausted. Though diplomatic efforts and other non-military means usually take a longer time, as we understand, it's very much time-consuming to negotiate, to talk. However, their effects are enduring and have less elective results. Fourth, the goal of protection should be to prevent or alleviate a humanitarian disaster rather than the overthrow a government in the state in question. Fifth, protection must be carried throughout the whole process, before the intervention, during the intervention, and after the intervention. The post-crisis rebuilding aim again and to prevention is fundamental. National reconstruction after intervention and protection should be giving sustained support. The country and the people should never be left in a mess. The protectors should be responsible for the post-intervention and the post-protection reconstruction of the state concerned. That should absolutely not smash and go, leaving a terrible mess to the country and the people subject to protection. Put it simply, there must be a responsibility to rebuild. Last but not least, the United Nations Security Council should establish a monitoring mechanism and an effective evaluation and accountability system. Such mechanism of supervision, outcome evaluation, and post-factum accountability will ensure the means, process, scope, results of protection. So to conclude, China will take a more active part in international and regional affairs to play a bigger role in solving global and regional issues by offering China's own solutions, offering China's own ideas, and also to add normative input. China is committed to working to push the international order to a more fair and reasonable direction, which will properly reflect the shift of power transition in this 21st century. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for a very interesting and to the point presentation. We now have quite a bit of time for Q&A, so does anybody have question or a comment? Yes, gentlemen.
Thank you. You mentioned that China does not have much of a business interest in Syria. However, what I see is it may not have business interest in Syria, but it does have, put it this way, a religion and a demographic interest, because Syria is a Muslim predominantly country, and China has a significant, although not majority, but being Muslim, and also in the past of the increasingly unstable Xinjiang. Do you think this has played a part in China's decision to veto this in the worry that it might fame of me? Make it more like it will be supporting kind of a conflict in the city, in a Muslim country that might worsen the instability in the Muslim parts in China.
Did everyone hear that on this side of it? Okay.
Well, probably you said, but for me, I feel differently. I think two things for China to veto. The first one, China usually not in favor of all these military actions, use of force. China is extremely cautious on that. Secondly, we concerns that the Libya case be repeated, because you overthrew the government, then left. Then the country will be broken, the fighting will be there, and the killing will be there. So it will be even messier, even bigger problem. And I think these two things really shaped, I understand, the Chinese decision-making. And after all, you know, China is one of the P5. Every time, I think it will be extremely important for P5 to have a thorough discussion. But however, to some extent, the P5 sometimes is divided. If you look at even in Libya case, why China abstained? Because we have our serious concerns, which didn't get much addressed. So in Syria's case, the worries are even bigger, because you have the Libya case out there. So I think, though we don't have much physical interest in Syria, but I think China voted for its understanding to support, reinforce its belief on the United Nations Charter's principles.
I think that the question was more about the Islamic connection, wasn't
yes,
it? And
yes.
The fact that, I mean, right now, I guess you're talking about ISIS and the growing problem with...
Also, Russia doesn't have that much of the Muslim population in its own country.
Yeah.
Indeed, I think the Muslim population tensions currently between non-Muslim and non-Muslim in China might have influenced China's execution of veto in the Syria case, because if they will see us involving or supporting in a poor or complicated Muslim country, it might look very good. Well, bad.
Yes. So there's this kind of linkage, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Which is that. Okay, I don't know who was first.
Well, it's actually to take time to give us this opportunity to know some personal information about the makers of Chinese foreign policy. But I think I might need some specification about where you see difference between what implications an intervention in Libya has had and what it would have in Syria, because you say, according to you, response protection means that China can make normative claims, but you radically reject the idea that other nations or states can have normative impact onto governance in the states in question. So regime change, which you criticized in your speech. So and you said China would make normative claims, and you said that you see a problem in Libya, that the coalition forces did not stay for any longer as was necessary to overthrow Gaddafi. So do you say that they should have stayed longer and made sure that the regime change would be achieved in a more peaceful way in the Libyan entity, and the same thing should have happened in Syria, and that's why China objected to the idea? Or are you saying that regime change should have been achieved through other means of diplomacy, I think I need some explanation.
Thank you very much. It's a good question. As a matter of fact, my understanding, the government, right, it usually thinks the government is a problematic, is the troublemaker of that. But I do see the government bears the primary responsibility to protect its own people. Right? So you've got a sovereign state, so the government is have the, all the mandate to protect that. But what happens actually is the outside intervention is tended to just support the opposition, for example, against the government. So that creates a much bigger problem, on that. And secondly, I think any kind of intervention, it should have, if it needs to be successful, it should have a unity of the P5 is very important, and also the wide support of the international community out there. And you need to make it right, to get it right. So you need to have, I put it in the before the intervention and during the intervention and also after the intervention. So now what the Libya case tells me is, at least, it is just that the only purpose is overthrow the government and then left. So who take care of the ongoing, who take care of the post-crisis period of nation building? That's a big problem, big concerns.
So what I meant is that I think that in the Libyan case, the Libyan people did not think that the government is protecting them any longer, and therefore Gaddafi has lost internal sovereignty. I think many European states have cooperated and worked together with Gaddafi for a long time as he had internal sovereignty and protected his people. And that provided a certain kind of stability in Northern Africa. When the civil war broke out, you can certainly say there was a big deal of hypocrisy there, that the European state supported intervention in Libya, as to what you correctly said, that they do not provide big state building, because they just, I think they helped to overthrow Gaddafi, and a new government or a new stability was quickly achieved, and some people say that was only to stop a refugee flow over Libya into Europe. And that's why you do not have any interventions in other Arab states that were affected by the Arab Spring.
Okay, you better get to the point.
Sorry. Yeah. I was going to say, how would China deal with this? Because you said they also have normative claims.
Mm-hmm.
But you say it's not for the Western states, only about overthrowing governments. But that would be the same thing for China, or not?
No, usually that's as a principle, we're not support any kind of efforts to just overthrow the government from the outside intervention. Of course, the people, they can do it. They can vote for it, or they can whatever they do it. So it's up to the people internally. If that happened internally, and we have sometimes we don't like it, but we have to live with it. But however, if it is outside impose of regime change, that's not going to work. Yeah.
Okay, we had two questions over here. Who's going to go first? Okay, we've got two. You first, yeah.
I have a question, because you said the Security Council is the only body with legitimacy for humanitarian intervention. Because national states, you rightly said, they have the hazard to abuse their power, as we've seen in Russia in 2008. I was wondering, I think you can't really see the United Nations Security Council as a benevolent ruler either, because you have such a power asymmetry within the security, within the five permanent members. You have no single developing country, for example, that makes you have the responsibility to protect, actually, in developing countries, if you live there. Yeah, it's mostly African countries. So I feel it's kind of like difficult to argue that they support five permanent members, make decisions in those countries without actually having an African voice, for example.
Well, China is a developing country, isn't it? It is. So it's number two, but the per capita income is really ranks 90s or something like that. So that really depends on the perspective.
It's so not about GDP, it's that you would not have the responsibility to take to be in China, for example. You could mostly infringe your countries in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So in these kind of countries, they would need to have a voice in the Security Council if you
want to
make a Security Council the main body to decide.
Oh, yeah. I absolutely agree with you that it needs to be Africa voice in the Security Council. But that's a bigger question of UN security reform, Security Council reform. That's, I don't think there's any kind of agreement in the near future. And I understand the group of four and many others, they are making their efforts, but, you know, it's difficult. That is a kind of problem, yes, I do believe. You argue that there should be Africa voice. Others said, well, that Europe has been overrepresented, and there should be more stakeholder in and to balance those European or others established powers like that. So that is I don't think it has so. But anyway, the Africa that can make their voice, for example, through the Africa Union, the regional groupings, they also play a part in shaping the policy making of the UN Security Council. But not decisive, I would say. But it can make its a point. Can make any voice be heard. Yeah.
Let someone else get it. Well, we can't just get started because there's so many people want to ask questions. Kirsten.
Yeah, thank you very much for the talk. I thought you raised a lot of other very interesting points. I have two brief questions. One is, could you say something more about the accountability mechanism in the Security Council that you propose would be set up? And the second is that most people who are against intervention would be very keen to see interveners get out of countries quickly if they do intervene. You set up quite an unusual position, which is don't intervene, respect sovereignty, but if you do intervene, stay in, rebuild, stay involved for a long time. There's like Michael Walzer would say, you go in and just save lives and then you leave and you let that society get on with building its own political system, you don't interfere. So I wonder if you could say something about that tension, that if you do end up intervening, you would suggest staying really very deeply involved in rebuilding for a long time.
Yeah, I answer your question in a reverse order because you touch a very important part. What is the purpose of intervening? To protect, right? To protect, you need also, do you have any kind of time frame for that? Because you before your intervention, you say, well, there is an atrocity here, the violation of human rights out here. But after, when you intervene, when the government has top down, are you sure that there's other people that don't need to protect because of the broken of the country and because of the infighting between different groups and armed groups all together? So this kind of the purpose of it, protection, should be preceded, should be carried on whether or not there is the government or not. So you protect, you just cannot just protect those period. Now, government top down, then left, left the country into a chaotic situation and a mess. That people, they also equally need to be protected. So the question you ask is, it's interesting. What is the accountability mechanism? So what I propose is that every intervention, if there is any, you should have established an ad hoc mechanism for that because each case might be different. the priority might be different. The situation out there is might be different. So you have to make an ad hoc measure to the case of the target country or target state.
So the woman at the back, yes.
Actually, the responsibility to protect the queen be successful in some way, because the decisions are made by these five countries and the other members of the council at that time. But these countries have their very serious problems with human rights protection at the domestic level, and they have very different approaches to human rights. So what can Argentina see in their claims that they are intervening in order to protect human rights in another country? And which human rights to protect, how, when to promote, to prioritize? How can they agree in something in the end?
You're right. This is the fact. This is a kind of a UN system. And many people complain, why you five countries have the veto power? Again, this is you have to go back to the origin of the establishment of this mechanism. And you are right. I have the same concern about that. And when you comment or judging other countries' human rights or whatever situation, and that does not necessarily mean they are perfect. As a matter of fact, nobody is perfect at all. But there are some people, there are some governments that will claim they are the perfect ones, so they are standing the higher moral ground and to judge others. Yeah.
There's someone from this side, so I haven't been here.
You talked a lot about how Chinese leaders' perception of sovereignty, literally sovereignty is a good thing, or at least instrumentally good thing to protect America. Actually, I quite agree that might emerge from the Chinese open spirits during the World War II. But the problem is, how long since the government thing put up with the sovereignty problem, between sovereignty versus human rights economy? At that time, sovereignty is something to protect human rights. But actually, the world is very diverse now. Some place outside of China, in some situations, sovereignty is really not the thing to protect human rights. I don't want to say about Libya or Syria. Let's say the case about Rwanda. At that time, we see a sovereignty-backed, organized massacre. At that time, regime change, as I may argue, is necessary. So I think Chinese leaders may too focus on sovereignty, but ignore the change. So,
well, I understand the Rwanda case really triggered all this debate as a very powerful case, because people very often mention about reference to Rwanda. So many people die, and the international community didn't do anything significant to prevent that sort of happens. Well, you mentioned about the sovereignty issue. I think that for most of the developing countries, they really, I think, the sovereignty is a very important. And also this principle, we have to say, that embedded in the United Nations Charter. And the UN Charter also have the principle of non-interference, right? But of course, there are some involvement of those principles. But however, when you make the decision to intervene, usually it happens always the big powers make the decision to intervene, the weak or smaller powers. Usually the stronger powers make the decision or takes the action to intervene others. You don't see very often a small power will have a powerful intervention of intervening of the major powers. Secondly, I don't rule out categorically any kind of intervention is unacceptable. As a matter of fact, and let me give you one example. In 1992, when the UN Security Council agreed that we will intervene in Cambodia, and it turns out a pretty successful case. The key of that actually is the P5. Again, I'm sorry about P5. P5's unity plays a significant role. They agree and then they will go to intervene the Cambodia. It brings quite a stability and quite an achievement out there. So what I'm trying to argue is that this intervention must be very strictly conditional. The condition is very important. You have to, for example, the unity of the U5, P5, and also that you have to take all these various consideration about the rebuild, for example, and the national reconstruction into your consideration. So to make any kind of possible intervention successful, if the P5 agreed.
Just think we've got. I think Professor Callahan was next.
I'm going to dinner with you, so I can ask you.
Okay.
Over
okay. So I think you were very early on. I'm sorry, I kind of forgot. But, yeah.
You are often portraying the China, the guardian of the international order, itemized by the authority of the UN, and you're also indicating your conclusion that China is ascending power in the 21st century global power position. How do you assess the likelihood that do you think the Chinese government is actually arguing that the international community has no obligation to act should there be a power gridlock happening in amongst the permanent members of the Security Council in the face of deteriorating crisis? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, this is actually, again, back to the orange of the UN system that gives this P5 the veto power. For whatever reason, the veto, that don't agree with each other. So it happens. Americans have vetoed numerous times on any kind of draft resolution concerning Israel-Palestinian issues. And so this is always there are some gridlock, but that does not mean that don't get along with each other. As I mentioned, Cambodia is a good example. Everybody come to a board and said, yes, we need to do something. And it turns out a good practice. So I think you're right. And China, we also, one of the P5, we have the responsibility. And so China is also working with many other stakeholders. And if you look at the UN veto record, China's veto, using the veto, the number is the least. And many others, you know, during the Cold War, the Russia was framed as Mr. Nit, Mr. No. And vice versa, Americans veto so many times. And for China, it's a very, we're refrained to doing that. But however, some people have a different view that to abstain is not a positive way to demonstrate your responsibility. So China need to speak out and to vote. With regard to the serious issues, there is a kind of view that when China vetoed this draft resolution with Russia, people say, well, you are not taking your responsibility. As a matter of fact, we think we just exercise our responsibility for that.
I like what you said about China offering its own ideas and normative input to strengthen the concept of R2P. But as you're aware, the UN already has several mechanisms, such as the special rapporteur, the Secretary General's process report on R2P, as well as now the recently appointed special advisor on R2P, Professor Jennifer Walsh at Oxford. And I wonder what engagements have there been? What efforts have there been by China to engage with these processes that exist at the UN level? And can you evaluate the level of success China has had in getting its own normative input in? And finally, where do you see this going forward? Is there been any more continual engagement on getting its normative input in to the concept?
Before I mentioned this R2P was endorsed in 2005. Before that, China also participated in any kind of all this discussing. And we're part of the, we send our representatives to talk and with them. Of course, but it is just endorsed in the World Summit. The United Nations endorse many other other stuff. But ultimately, if there is any kind of intervention ought to take place, you need to the approval of the United Nations Security Council. So United Security Council actually takes the last shot, no matter so on what kind of situation, what kind of agreement you have. So it ultimately needs to the P5 to make that decision. So that, of course, put lots of pressure on the P5, so you need to exercise your responsibility to that. I think this does not mean there's no talk or communication or consultation with each other. I do believe there's numerous consultations going on, but every time we come to the Security Council, that was the real battle.
Well, thank you for the talk, and I very much agree with you that China is much comfortable with the international community. But when I listen to you very carefully about your idea about unresponsible, it doesn't really remind me of any great speech by Chinese leaders on the peaceful rise of China. Rather, actually, curiously, it reminded me of Tony Blair's speech in Chicago in 1998 on the doctrine of international community. And much of that speech was born from the just war theory anyway. And fast forward to 2003, we've seen what happened in Iraq, and people challenged him about the UN mechanism. He gave the argument of UNSCR of 1441 on this basis, and we've all seen what happened with this part of the talks of reconstruction and nation building before the war. So isn't the inconvenient truth this, no matter how sound it may be in theory, isn't the truth that any intervention is very, very difficult and is, you know, very much dependent on the political dynamics at the time?
Well, this is what I said is my personal view. Actually, it is not the official doctrine yet. So I have to make that very clear about it. It's also an academic exploration of this interesting concept, because like others, academias. The point is, I think for China now, it is necessary, I mean, for China to add more normative input. In the past, probably for China, just simply say no, or we're not going to go for it. But how could you justify that sort of thing? So this is a new challenge for China. And the other people, they also urge China to do more on this. So I think these are just a part of the effort. And of course, in this law shaping, agenda setting, rulemaking for China, is a new student. It's a new student. All this has been basically dominated by the developed world. But that does not mean China and others, developing countries, they're going not to have a say. As a matter of fact, we have seen this kind of power transition, like it a lot. It's already undergoing very profound change. And it needs to hurt more voice or input from developing or non-Western countries' voice. And let me give you one example. When I was working in Washington, D.C., I just happened to be there. That is the financial crisis in 2008, starting from the Wall Street. At that time, you have the GA, for example. Now, of course, already G7, because Russia has been kicked out. But, you know, when Washington want to assemble a conference, it understands perfectly well if they still do it in G8 scope or level, it will not going to confront or respond to that kind of financial tsunami. So it needs much more countries, much more particularly developing economies to get involved in this. So that's why the G20 was born out there, and China was in, and many others developing was in. So That is to say, there is also a growing demand from the developed world that need to hear more about the developing voice, developing countries' voice, and after all, that needs also developing countries to do more together to confront that kind of crisis. And another related to this is because this world system, this world order has been largely shaped by the World War II, that kind of period, and basically the American and the Europeans is the dominate both World Bank and the IMF. However, in 2009, in the St. Petersburg summit in the United States, the G20 agreed, the G20 pledged to reform the IMF and the World Bank to reflecting the rising of the developing nations, developing countries, the rising of the rest, right? The rising of the rest does not mean the demise of the West. The rising of the rest does not mean the demise of West, right? But actually, you have to reflect all this. But however, we haven't seen any kind of breakthrough yet. The decision was there, but, you know, America is very much reluctant. So it's just a block of the decision.
You want to have another question, yes. But is there anyone else? Because you've already had one. So we've got a couple there. Demetrius, I think you were first, and then, yeah.
Demetrius. Thank you very much for your presentation. My question is follow-up. Do you think that a challenge for China is because the RTP is very Eurocentric or very liberal for a while?
Well, to some extent, that makes sense. That makes sense. And of course, now the point here is actually that this R2P is to challenge to challenge the sovereignty. But of course, as I put it, the United Nations can make a decision if the P5 agrees. However, because it is so important, so sensitive, so always there is a lot of debate among P5s. The principle is out there, the need to exercise more protection. However, because of the loose of the conditionalities inserted on this R2P, so it can be very easily be abused by major powers. That's the concern for many other countries.
Can you give best and worst example?
50 or 15. This is not just R2P. If you talk about R2P, you have to talk something after 2005, right? So you ask in that last 50 years. At this moment, I think two examples, relatively successful. Why I mentioned the Cambodia issue, right? The Cambodia issues says 1992, it has been fairly a soft landing. The second, well, you can see, for example, Afghanistan is a very interesting case. So far, it seems that Afghanistan, that the Taliban has been top down and American troops on the ground. It seems that it is working. However, the bigger problem is about post-2014, American going to leave. The little troops were going to leave. So that is a bigger question now. So who will really take care of the security of that? But people say, well, the Afghanistan's its own national troops can perform, can deliver, but it's unpredictable. That really you need to put them on the ground to try to test on that. But there is a kind of uncertainty out there. So Afghanistan issues, if you look at from now to the past 10 years, the top-down, the kind of rulers and regime of Taliban and also reduce, to some extent, reduce or manage the terrorist activities out there, but not going to rule out the terrorism. You can see this ISIS is almost coming back. But I will say the Cambodia. And also maybe another example is East Timor. Right? Maybe East Timor is another example. Everybody agree. And not only the P5, but also the Asia and Australia, all those are very positive on making that. So it is a kind of, there are some, but not very much. But if we talk about the R2P, the first case ought to be the Libya, the Libya war. But that was really raised more questions than answers. This ISIS is, I guess there's no disagreement about that, the nature of this terrorist group, and there's a format in performing. In principle, we support to fight against the terrorism. We support it. Of course, in the same time, we fight against the combat the terrorism. The terrorism is a terrorism, no matter where they are, no matter where they come from. But sometimes for me, I have a problem with the double standards that people put on the terrorism. But with regard to ISIS, I don't think we have any problem, and we should support it. But China will not going to put any troops or any kind of sort of thing. But anyway.
Why not?
Why not? Americans, nobody ever wants to put its boots on the ground. Even Britain. And
no, that's the problem. No one will do it. So, I know you've had long questions, so I will give you a chance at the end, yeah?
Correctly framed everything in terms also of the power transition that is ongoing power transition. And yes, we have growing power with growing responsibilities, but it means also growing interest and much broader exposure also to risk, global risk. Now, my question there is, the big question here with regard to intervention in China, for me at least, is what would Beijing do? Let me put it in this in a hypothetical scenario. When Beijing is confronted with a federal regime in Africa, with which has significant political, economic, cultural ties that undergoes significant domestic transition, possibly revolution, possibly civil war, and no P5, no UN Security Council resolution authorizing any intervention whatsoever, what would Beijing do in that specific case? Because it has interests to protect, so put differently, China possibly can resist temptations of regime change, but I'm wondering whether it can resist the temptation of regime maintenance in this situation.
Well, I think, first of all, the priority we urge the parties concerned to talk. Non-military means the political dialogue, political talk, that's surely come to the first. In the same time, if, presumably, there is a United Nations Security Council's decision, China, we will do much more than you think. For example, China now today is one of the, China is pretty active in peacekeeping. For example, in the world. We contribute to the largest peacekeepers among P5. We do much more than Britain. We do much more than the United States and other permanent members. But the conditionality is there must be a UN mandate for that.
Okay, you get your second question, yeah?
If China vetoes against intervention style action to protect, okay, should it instead offer asylum to those people affected, especially those who disputed from the area, so that they at least have the chance to enjoy human rights in China or human rights in Chinese characteristics?
No silence at all. Let me take Syria as an example. China is all vetoed, as I said. However, China worked very hard to mediate the talk and the negotiation. So China sent its special envoys to Syria. And China has proposed a six-point proposal. And China has working with other stakeholder members in the United Nations, not only the Security Council, but also an enlarging contest. So China has been working in promoting the kind of dialogue. But the problem, why the kind of crisis is still hang on, right? And there is a debate. As a matter of fact, the opposition has received a lot of overseas support. That is the fact. They receive large amount of money. They receive a large amount of weapons, even smuggled into Syria. So if the opposition secure all these endless increasing support, they don't have much desirability to talk. They think they can win the war. So this is a dynamic. This is a dynamic paradox of any kind of crisis, particularly it involved the government and the opposition.
Those weapons going to Syria are coming mainly from Arab states and Turkey, not from Europe.
I don't mean from Europe. I mean from outside.
Yeah,
I know where it comes from.
Yeah. So, okay. One last question, I think. Yeah.
Well, I'm still going to ask as well. Do you think China should become some ally in order to enhance and promote China's solution towards
Developing some sort of
ally?
China pursue a foreign policy of independent, peaceful foreign policy of independence. No allies. We have partners.
You have one, right?
Sorry. So usually we have partners, various kinds of partners. This is a. Let me share with you one of the anecdotes. On one occasion, the former U.S. Secretary, Madame Albright, Secretary of State, and had a conversation with Li Zhaoxi, the former Chinese foreign minister. Albright asked Li Zhaoxi, just tell me, what's the keywords for China's foreign policy? Li Zhaoxi said, you first, lady first, so you tell me, now I will give you my answer. And Albright said, leadership. America is leadership. Then Li Zhaoxi said, our keyword is partnership. So I just want to tell you that there is a kind of debate, probably you noted that inside China, academia, some kind of opinion China should form or have its allies or whatsoever. But I'm not a fan of that. I'm not a fan. I think partnership is a brilliant idea.
Partnership is good for McMahon.
So who do you think China should make, apart from North Korea, which is already now?
Probably a developing world, like the weak countries.
Brazil.
Developing that probably is a way to challenge the Western communist world.
align.
Yeah, you can do it in partnership, not necessarily align. So align is very different. To be align or have align is not all that kind of beautiful things. Sometimes you have to do something you really don't want. And let me give you one example. Very recently, Japan wanted very much to have a better relationship with Russia, right? Abe himself tried his best to cultivate his personal relationship with Putin whatsoever. He has done a lot of job. But all of a sudden, you have a Ukraine crisis. So what Japan were going to do, you have to join the West. You have to join Americans and others to put sanctions on Russia. I don't think this is what really the Japanese want. The Japan alternative, they want a better relationship with Russia. But because it's an ally of the West, so they have to do something. It's a pretty hard choice, I know. So Russia was very, very angry about it. So of course, it will put their relationship in a very bad shape, and it's no way to improve it. So I think this, I like this, by the way, this partnership. It's so flexible.
I think you've answered a lot of questions after a very interesting talk, and so many questions. And very good questions. Thank you all, and thank you for your answers. This is an ongoing situation, obviously, and hopefully you can come back again and update us next year when the Syrian conflict is resolved and ISIS is controlled and everything. But and we look forward to seeing China's diplomacy evolving in ways that will help to resolve some of these problems along the lines that you suggest. But it's getting late, and it's Friday evening, and I think we should give you a rest, and you a rest.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.